146 days of the ongoing U.S.-Israel genocide in Gaza. A fresh Israeli massacre kills more than 100 Palestinians and injures hundreds of others. Palestinian resistance fighters inflict more losses on invading Israeli forces in Gaza as fighting on the ground rages on. Also in the headlines, Iran successfully launches yet another domestically built research satellite into space. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The scenes of horrific killing of Palestinians have become common ever since the Israeli regime launched its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. The regime forces have massacred scores more Gazans who were waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza City. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 104 people were killed after Israeli snipers shot directly at a crowd waiting for aid in the early morning. Hundreds more sustained injuries. The dead and wounded have been taken to Al-Shifa and Kamal Adwan hospitals. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has condemned the attack, saying that it was a cold-blooded massacre. Palestinian resistance movements Hamas and the Islamic Jihad have also censured the massacre of Gazans. Palestinians are already struggling with shortages of food, as the Israeli regime is using starvation as a weapon against them. Shortages have caused a surge in malnutrition among children, with the UN warning of a looming famine. The Israeli genocide has so far killed over 30,100 Gazans. The U.S.-managed Israeli genocidal war continues to take innocent lives and to leave a trail of destruction in the Gaza Strip. Israel's bombing and shelling campaign since October the 7th has turned a large part of Gaza into rubble. A spokesman for the Gaza Health Ministry gives details about the catastrophic situation in the besieged territory.
The estimated casualties of the Israeli aggression stand at approximately 30,000 martyrs and over 70,500 injuries. This points to a systematic policy by the Israeli occupation of committing genocide in the Gaza Strip. Furthermore, this aligns with reports indicating the disappearance of 10,000 individuals. 70% of these martyrs are children and women, in addition to nearly 10% of the martyrs being elderly. Therefore, the Israeli occupation is carrying out a clear process of executing families. There are thousands of families that have been completely annihilated.
They are 30,000 martyrs. I don't know what the Israelis want from us and why they killed this number. It is a genocide of the Palestinian people. This is what I see, a genocide. Who bombs a tower on civilian residents, including women and children?
We've never witnessed such a number before. I'm 52 years old and I've lived through many wars, including the 82 war, which we heard about when we were young, as well as the first and second intifadas. The number of 30,000 martyrs has never been reached in such a short period, 4 months, 5 months. The intifada lasted for years, yet this number wasn't reached, nor was the number of injuries. The goal here is killing, not just displacement, but murder and extermination.
This has become a genocide unlike anything we've ever seen. Everyone is suffering inside these tents. We're dying slowly in addition to high cost of living and the people enduring pain. We are suffering greatly. We have been displaced about 100 times.
Israel's relentless bombings of the Gaza Strip and the obstacle to aid delivery have left Palestinians without food and other essentials. The UN has also warned that a quarter of Gaza's population is just one step away from famine. The lack of food has forced a displaced family to eat cactus leaves in order to survive. Let's take a listen to their harrowing narratives.
Today we are living in famine. We have exhausted everything. There is nothing left to eat. We used to eat a plant called mallow. It no longer exists. There used to be carrot and that is gone. There is nothing left in the markets. So we resorted to the last option. The cactus. We eat cactus even with its thorns. We even feed the young children cactus. A little girl is eating cactus instead of milk, instead of meat, instead of eggs. Today we can still find cactus. In a week the cactus will no longer be available and we will live on nothing. We will become dead. I, in approximately 1 month, and I have a photo, have lost some 30 kilograms this month. 1 month. I have lost 30 kilograms. Why? Because there is no food. This is our food now in the northern Gaza Strip. There is nothing else. Everything is gone. There is nothing left.
There is nothing. I have newborn babies. What should I feed them? They have become anemic. They have contracted due to lack of food and nutrition. So now we are eating cactus. I also ate from it. I ate cactus. I had cactus for lunch. We thank God. There is nothing left for us to eat.
Palestinian fighters keep putting stiff resistance to Israeli forces in Gaza as fighting on the ground rages on. The military wing of the Hamas resistance movement says it has targeted a group of Israeli soldiers in Gaza City with mortars. Hassan Brigade says that it has shelled Israeli armored vehicles there. Meanwhile, fighting continued in the southern city of Khan Yunis, where the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says that its fighters hit an Israeli Merkava tank as well as a military bulldozer. Israel has so far confirmed the killing of 243 of its troopers since the regime launched a ground invasion of Gaza in late October. Palestinian groups say that the regime is intentionally hiding the real number of casualties among its forces in order to avoid the Israeli public anger. The Lebanese resistance movement has conducted yet another operation on Israel in response to the regime's attacks along Lebanon's southern border. Hezbollah has said that it has targeted an Israeli military position in the occupied Lebanese Sheba farms. The group has also launched another operation targeting a gathering of Israeli soldiers with missiles weapons. The operation inflicted direct losses on the Israeli forces. The Lebanese resistance movement also targeted the cities of Ilan and Haifa in the occupied territories. Meanwhile, Israel's artillery targeted the town of Nakura in southern Lebanon. The regime's drone also fell on the outskirts of the Lebanese town of Labune. Clashes between Hezbollah and Israel have been raging since October 7. That is when Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza. Iran has launched yet another homegrown satellite as the country aims to bridge the gap with other nations in the race for space dominance. Farzana Ashudian reports.
The new satellite Pars 1 aboard Soyuz launch vehicle was blasted off from a Russian space base and successfully put into orbit 500 kilometers above Earth. The imaging and research satellite will provide a set of remote sensing data that can be used in various fields, including land, forest, water monitoring, and mining and energy transmission lines. The domestically made satellite weighs nearly 150 kilograms and is capable to capture images of 95% of Iranian territory.
The Pars 1 satellite is a two-way researching satellite built by the Iran Space Research Institute and has three types of applications for collecting data from the Earth's surface. The first payload of the color spectrum with an accuracy of 15 meters, the second payload with an accuracy of 150 meters for thermal imaging, and a payload with 300 meters accuracy for imaging with shortwave infrared spectra, which is used to identify plant and forestry pests.
Some Iranians gathered in the country's Space Research Institute to watch the event and express their thoughts about this launch.
We are very proud of this moment. This cooperation between the two countries shows the country's development in international interactions.
I came here today to see this proud moment, and I hope that in the future I can play an influential role in Iran's technological developments.
Pars 1 is designed and manufactured by experts and young scientists with the cooperation of knowledge-based companies. This is the second foreign launch of Iranian satellite. Last year, Iran launched Khayyam satellite from a space launching pad in Kazakhstan. Iran is among the world's top 10 countries capable of developing and launching satellites.
The latest launch is an important step forward in the country's space program. Despite sanctions imposed by Western countries in recent years, Iran is excelling in a wide range of technological developments, including in the space sector. Farzan Ashuryan, Tehran.
Obviously a major achievement for Iran. Let's bring in Mohammad Amin Ahangari. He's an expert in aerospace technology who joins us in the studios. Welcome to the program. So a major achievement for Iran. Tell us about this Pars 1, what it's all about.
Pars 1, satellite, is an important achievement. And it's different from the previous satellites launched by Iran. The most important satellite, the most important achievement is that the satellite is over 150 kilos. It was manufactured by domestic companies. And we launched it to the height of 500 kilometers. And it was done by a Russian carrier. But the satellite is fully homegrown. This is a major development because the previous satellites were smaller and they were technically known as cubic satellites. And their application was for research purposes and they were put into a lower altitude. But this satellite is heavier. This can be considered as a major breakthrough with respect to homegrown satellites in Iran, and it's more applicable compared to other satellites.
All right, very well. Thank you very much for that, Mohammad Amin Ahangari, expert in aerospace technology here in the studios. Thank you for explaining this to us. Podcaster and journalist Esha Krishnaswamy joined us earlier from St. Petersburg with her take on the Iranian satellite launch from a Russian base.
I've been reading what Western papers have been saying, and they are saying that it expresses like concerns over Iran's ties with Moscow, etc. So they are definitely concerned about this because they want to have space hegemony or be one of the only people who are capable of doing this. And when other countries do this, it incites fear. But for Iran, what it does is that because Iran is a victim of so much terrorism and sabotage, it can help them monitor this and put an end to a lot of these issues where pipelines get sabotaged or get blown up due to acts of terrorists. So for Iran, it is vital for their national security interests. And so I think that it is overall something Iran needs in order to confront the real threats to their nation. It says that Iran is able to defend itself very capably. On top of that, I think these sanctions forced Iran into creating a self-sufficiency because they couldn't import parts that other nations could. And because of it, they have to manufacture everything at home. And so I think it helped create a self-sufficiency that made Iran ironically stronger if it weren't for the sanctions.
Iranians will cast their ballots for a new parliament and a deliberative body called the Assembly of Experts on Friday. More than 61 million people are eligible to elect their representatives from over 15,000 candidates who are competing in the elections. Earlier, we discussed the significance of this year's elections in our News Review program. Let's take a listen to what our guests had to say.
On this segment of the program in Iran, candidates vying for seats in parliament and the Assembly of Experts have wrapped up their election campaigns. Millions of Iranians will be heading to the polls on Friday to cast their ballots for the 290-member parliament and the 88-seat Assembly of Experts. Iran's Interior Ministry says over 15,000 candidates are competing in the parliamentary elections this year, a record since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The Iranian legislative body called the Majlis is elected for a four-year term. Hundreds of candidates are also in the fray for the Assembly of Experts, a deliberative body elected for 8 years. In his recent speech, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called for massive voter turnout for elections, which he described as the main pillar of the Islamic Republic. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Gisumi Shahmadi, who's joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also, we have journalist, author, and producer Sakina Datu joining us from the British capital, London. Welcome to the program. to the both of you. Let's start off with Gisu in Tehran. Gisu, you've been following the elections very closely. Talk to us about the mood and the atmosphere leading into Friday's elections. And if you can also explain the election process for us.
Tell you that today, 8 o'clock local time, campaigning stopped. All campaigning activities, actually, according to law, was supposed to stop. The candidates did have until this morning enough time to present their political views or their programs in case they're elected into the Iranian parliament. Now, it is quite interesting to see so many candidates taking part in the elections this time around. More than 15,000 candidates, and 12% of them are women, Badia, which is, again, another very significant number of women taking part in these elections. Also makes the elections this time around very interesting to watch. So at the same time, simultaneously, we do know that the Assembly of Experts is also holding its elections at the same time. And the Assembly of Experts itself is a very important institution in the Islamic Republic of Iran. You know that they are tasked with choosing the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and also they oversee the actions of the leader as well. So that's a very important democratic institution as well. Aside from the parliament, with all the power that the Iranian parliament has as a democratic institution, again, as well.
Thanks, Gisu. Let's bring in our guest in London, Sakina Datu. Ms. Datu, give us your views about the upcoming elections and what's at stake at the ballot box on Friday.
So one of the things I think that I find very interesting is the amount of candidates that are vying, you know, 15,000. Looking on from here, this is a sign of a space, a public space that is open to everybody. And unlike what, you know, the Western media here or the Western politicians will make us believe that Iran is a theocracy, it does not have democracy, but watching these elections, it is very obvious that there is an open space for everyone, and this is really a sign of a thriving, a progressive country. There's also a lot of you know, talk around here about trying to instigate, for example, Iranians not to turn out in large numbers, to reduce the voter turnout, because this would signify that people are not happy with what's going on. And I just think that this is a message, you know, for Iranians to be very cautious internally, to understand that there are different forces working towards destabilizing a lot of things. But I just want to say that there are problems in every nation. Economic issues are not limited to Iran. They are a global problem at the moment. And I think internally, Iranians should remember that there is a huge leadership that Iran shows around the world in issues of Palestine, on morality, on moral politics around the world, in science, with the launch of, for example, the satellite.
Okay, let's leave it there. Thanks to Gisu Mishamadi, your correspondent, joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. And thanks to journalist, author, and producer Sakina Datu, joining us from the British capital, London. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
After more than 4 months of the Zionist regime's brutal onslaught against the besieged Palestinian people, the world must ensure Tel Aviv's legal, economic, and political isolation. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, since the Zionist regime's genocidal onslaught against the Gaza Strip began last October, millions of people around the world have been experiencing a kind of paralysis. This is not necessarily an absolute paralysis. People are still able to engage in activities such as protest aimed at ending the genocide. They're asking fundamental questions about everything they thought they knew or took for granted about their states, governments, ideologies, media, educational systems, and international institutions. We do not suffer from lack of words to describe the realities of genocide, global imperialism, and the Israeli regime's settler colonial brutality. Such analyses are plentiful, written by scholars, journalists, and activists in Palestine and beyond. South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice is an excellent example. We also do not suffer from an absence of actions that are capable of truly challenging status quo power relations. Economic and political disruption is critical to forcing change, and we have seen many activist groups bravely engaging in such actions in the US, UK, Canada, and elsewhere. Indeed, the aforementioned paralysis does not disable our ability to describe the genocide and take action against it. Rather, the entrenchment and dominance of political, economic, social, legal, and cultural institutions stops the majority of people from taking the next step to radically transform these institutions. The task seems immeasurable, the risks high, and the desired outcome not at all guaranteed, but if people are truly going to take the next step and create consequences for the Zionist settler colonialism, then the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement must be adopted by institutions worldwide. Two key reasons underlie this state of paralysis: the idea that the Palestinian cause is a lost one, and the notion that an alternative world is too risky a proposition given all the uncertainty this would entail. Palestine may be a losing cause at the moment, but it is not a lost cause. Giving up on the Palestinian struggle is nothing short of giving up on the decolonial project or the aspiration to usher in a world that no longer operates on global imperialist structures and where all people can live a dignified, sovereign, and free life. Thank you. If Palestinians are not free, then the Euro-American imperial and colonial project continues. That project has only one goal, to generate wealth and power for Euro-American empires. So long as this project continues, the large majority of peoples in the global south, along with indigenous communities and exploited peoples across the global north, will not be free. The path towards an alternative decolonial world will always carry a degree of uncertainty and risk, but this risk is worth it, and the Palestinian case helps explain why. The struggle for Palestine is worth the risk because the current path poses an unacceptable certainty: genocide. If we remain on this path, the genocide of the Palestinian people will continue until only a small fraction of those living between the river and the sea are Palestinian. They will become the oppressed minority, forced to live under exclusive Israeli-Jewish sovereignty. This type of genocidal project will not stop with the Palestinian people. The Zionist regime's current actions are sending a clear message to empires that settler colonialism is still possible in the 21st century, and that imperial outposts in any region of the world can serve imperial interest, thus ensuring the continuation of Euro-American colonial violence. There are consequences to genocide. People do not just forget about it and move on. Millions of people around the world now believe that this imperial world order understands only the language of force. It is impossible to predict where this might lead, but another world war is a real possibility. At some point, the peoples brutalized by US-led Western imperialism will find a release valve on a mass scale. There is no greater risk than the path we are currently treading, that of war and genocide. We need an alternative, and while that route is uncertain, we are not without a compass. There are many excellent alternative forms of social and political organization that we can learn from colonized people and regions, both historically and in the present, ones that emphasize collective well-being, participatory democracy, respect for all cultural groups, living in harmony with nature, and embracing a multitude of identities. There is a better way forward. Let this be a moment to shed the state of paralysis and commit ourselves to a long-term struggle for Palestinian decolonial liberation through BDS, that is, boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against the fabricated regime of Israel. The legal, economic, and political isolation for the child killer regime of Israel is the only viable alternative to genocide and war.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. We're going to start off by learning about a game-changing concept. It's going to be Quranic taqwa. taqwa as prescribed by the Quran, Quranic haq. A game-changing concept. I want to share some of the verses of the Quran which talks about the gifts that God will give us if we can embrace Quranic taqwa. We've made that dua. But again, because this is such a big axe from Allah, and because it would do so much for our community and for hastening the reappearance of the Imam, we should definitely ask Imam al-Askari for help. You see, as it was mentioned in the poetry, this Imam is known for generosity. Many times, we don't know our Imams. We don't know how generous they are. He was known for his generosity, even for giving, not only generous, but even those who, in our hearts and minds, undeserving, but the Imam would give. Let alone those who have serious spiritual needs, brothers and sisters who are sitting literally preparing for their Imam of the time. So I want to just give one story about our Imam's generosity, and then after that we'll move on to our Quranic taqwa. So the person who's telling this story about generosity is a person who is undeserving. Hopefully you and I, when we hear a story like this, it will inspire us to act on a big night like this so that he guides us and he takes our hand. The person's name is Ismail, telling the story. Ismail was a professional beggar. He's telling the story. He says that I knew the route that Imam al-Askari would walk on. I know he's noble, I know he's kind, I know he's generous. I know the route that he's going to walk on. And he said, what I did was I went and I carefully sat over there knowing the Imam is going to come. Once the Imam passed, right, so the Imam's now there and now I'm able to address him, Yabna Rasulullah, he said, I started to tug on the Imam's heartstrings. Wallah, I don't have anything, not even a dirham, no food, can't take care of my family, the bare essentials, please. Swearing by Allah, wallah. Ismail says, he says, when I said this, the Imam said, you're saying wallah, you're swearing by God, even though you, right now, you've got 200 gold dinars buried for a rainy day. You've got 200 gold dinars buried, and you're swearing, I have nothing, no food, can't feed my family. But the Imam said this. He said, I didn't tell you that because I don't want to give you, Ismail. It's not because I'm not generous or I'm going to stop. He turned to his servant. His servant is with the Imam. He said, how much do you have with you? The servant's carrying money for the Imam. The servant had 100 gold dinars. The Imam said, give them. The man gave them to Ismail. After he gave them to Ismail, Ismail says, he says that the Imam turned to me. He said, you're going to need those 200 dinars that you have buried. You're going to need them, and you won't find them when you need them. Ismail, alhamdulillah, he goes on about his business. Ismail said, he said, the prophecy of the Imam was true, and the words of the Imam were absolutely correct. I did have 200 dirhams. I was a professional beggar. I had 200 dirhams hidden for a rainy day. I was thinking, I'll get a little bit from the Imam. And he said that later on, the time came when I needed those 200 dirhams. The doors of rizq were absolutely closed. But I remembered, alhamdulillah, I have my 200 gold dirhams buried safely. He said, I went over there to get my dirhams. And I find that there's nothing left. He says, my son had found out that I had buried the dirhams. And he stole them, like father, like son. Right? So now, back to our point. The original point was this. Our Imam is very generous. We just need to do tawassul to him. We need to ask him because we're trying to prepare for the Imam of the times. Now, brothers and sisters, what we're doing now is we're starting off with Quranic taqwa. Quranic taqwa is the first chapter of our book. In that Quranic chapter, there's going to be, and he's going to do this a lot, he will be redefining terms for us. There will be terms which we may have a certain understanding, the way we were taught, the way it was in Sunday school, what the community believes, And a big part of this book is redefining those terms. But again, if we can redefine them, Quranic taqwa, as I mentioned, is a game changer. It's a preliminary for victory. And now, brothers and sisters, because we're going to, this is a Quranic process, I want to just see if you can follow along with me, and we'll look at some of the ayat of the Quran, which talk about the Quran being a stepping stone for victory. So one of them, brothers and sisters, if you can either look in your book, or it's probably easier on your phones. If anybody has a copy of the Quran on their phone, if they can look at Surah Baqarah, so Surah 2, and verse number 189. And I'll just wait to see if I can see on sister's sides, if anybody has found that verse, Surah Baqarah, which would be number 2, and verse number 189. So the last part of that verse should read in this way. Ittaqullah, have taqwa of Allah, fear God, be God wary, la'allakum tuflihun, perhaps you will experience success, right? It's a stepping stone for victory, right? Quranic taqwa, if we get Quranic taqwa. And when we look at the ahadith of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, we'll see that not only do they tell us stories of these great anbiya, they tell us why they won, why they were successful. One example. This is now from Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Salawat please. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Our Imam is describing not only what happened to the prophets, but why they won. And these are lessons for us. وَبِالتَّقْوَى نَجَى نُوحْ وَمَا مَعْهُ فِي السَّفِينَةِ. And it was because of taqwa that Nabi Nuh and those who were with him in the ark were saved. Right? وَصَالِحْ وَمَا مَعْهُ مِنَ السَّائِقَةِ. Nabi Salih, the people of Thamud, those who were mu'mineen, why is it that they were saved from the thunderbolt? It was again because of that taqwa. Brothers and sisters, if we can get Quranic taqwa, and I'm going to show another, share another hadith of Ahlul Bayt, God will act as our eyes and ears. Meaning, there will be things that we would normally not be able to see, not be able to take into consideration. But because we had taqwa, we are trying to do what God says. Again, with the Quranic point of view, God will show us things that we can't see. We can't see around the corner, God will show. He'll act as our ears and our eyes. This is again from the Imam. He says this, إِنَّ اللَّهَ عَزَّ وَجَلْ, truly God, عَزَّ وَجَلْ, يَقِي بِالتَّقْوَى عَنِ الْعَبْدِ, God will ward off, because of taqwa, from the servant. What will he ward off from the servant? مَا عَزَبَ عَنْهُ أَقْلُهُ, those things that his aql wasn't able to take into consideration. I made all the calculations. I thought, I planned. There were some things that escaped me. God will show me. And what else? There'll be certain blind spots, things that I wasn't aware of, things that I couldn't plan for. Again, the Imam says, وَيُجْلِي بِالتَّقْوَى عَنْهُ عَمَاهُ وَجَهْلَ. There'll be blind spots, things that I wasn't aware of. He will show them.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمني صل عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you.
Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said Britain is in the throes of a hidden poverty epidemic, with the worst affected households living in squalor and going without food, heating and everyday basics. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to new food insecurity data, millions of people, including one in five families with children, have gone hungry or skipped meals in recent weeks because they could not regularly afford to buy groceries. According to the Food Foundation tracker, 15% of British households, equivalent to approximately 8 million adults and 3 million children, experienced food insecurity in the month of January, as high food prices continued to hit the pockets of low-income families. Experts warned the persistence of high levels of food insecurity among low-income families was a health emergency that would drive the prevalence of conditions linked to poor nutrition, such as malnutrition and rickets. Nearly two-thirds or 60% of food insecure households reported buying less fruit, and 44% bought fewer vegetables as they struggled with the ongoing cost of living crisis in Britain. By contrast, just 11% of food secure households bought less fruit and 6% purchased fewer vegetables. Although the Foundation has previously reported the amount of vegetables bought by British households has fallen to a 50-year low, the latest tracker data shows the situation is far worse for low-income families. Citing Guardian revelations that the National Health Service has recorded an increase in hospital admissions for nutrient deficiency, the Foundation said falling fruit and vegetable consumption among the poorest people in Britain was likely to widen health inequalities and put added strain on the National Health Service. The Foundation said, although inflation had decreased in recent months, food prices remained high. It said the price of a reasonably costed, adequately nutritious weekly basket of food has increased by 24 to 26% in the past 2 years. Food insecurity levels, based on a regular Food Foundation survey of more than 6,000 people, have fallen slightly from 17.5% in January of 2023, but remain as high as they were in the chaotic first weeks of the pandemic in 2020. The Foundation said the ongoing cost of living crisis meant food insecurity had become, in effect, the norm for many people in Britain. Millions of low-income families in Britain, being unable to afford to access regular and healthy food, has focused attention on the inadequacy of social security support in Britain. According to the Food Foundation's latest data, 45% of households in receipt of universal credit, the main low-income benefit, reported experiencing food insecurity. The Foundation said all children in families on universal credit should be automatically entitled to free school meals. there is increasing concern that from April, the government will discontinue the Household Support Fund, a £900 million a year hardship fund administered by English councils and widely used to fund school holiday meal vouchers for families with children on free school meals. Michael Marmot, a public health expert and professor of epidemiology at University College London, said, "There are fewer needs more basic than nutritious food for you and your children. In Britain, in 2024, one in five households with children cannot meet that basic need. They are simply too poor, and the poorer they are, the less likely they are to be able to meet that need." A government spokesperson claimed, "We recognise the pressures people are facing, which is why we are providing £104 billion in cost of living support, worth on average £3,700 per household, while our healthy food schemes are helping more than 3 million children." But Henry Dimbleby, a former government food advisor and the author of 2021 National Food Strategy, called the latest statistics a health emergency that would cast a long shadow on public health. Website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. The former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said Britain is in the throes of a hidden poverty epidemic, with the worst affected households living in squalor and going without food, heating and everyday basics such as clean clothes and toothpaste. Gordon Brown charged the Conservative government with creating a wall of silence around obscene levels of destitution in the United Kingdom, and criticised ministers for systematically shredding a social security system that had once provided a safety net for the poorest people in Britain. Gordon Brown said it was a moral outrage that the government was unwilling to tackle a social emergency that had created millions of forgotten and voiceless victims, one he compared in an article for The Guardian with the post office scandal in terms of the scale of ministerial neglect. Gordon Brown said, "In years to come, I believe people will be asking how it was that government walked by on the other side when thousands of children were suffering abject deprivation and failed to support them in their hours of need." He described the poverty he had witnessed in his hometown of Kirkcaldy in Scotland, where 70% of children were in poverty in some neighbourhoods, as the worst he had seen in his lifetime. He said in a recent interview, "In 2010, we were helping 100 children at Christmas through charity schemes. Last Christmas, it was 1,800. He described Britain as haunted by poverty we thought had been consigned to history. He said the situation was deteriorating for destitute families whose children lacked proper clothing or had to share beds, whose parents felt shame because they could not provide and feared their children would be taken into care as a result. Gordon Brown challenged Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, to use his March budget to address the suffering of families for whom 2024 was shaping up to be financially the worst year in living memory. He said, "In an advanced economy, understanding these privations shouldn't be a question of ideology, but a question of decency." Gordon Brown called on Jeremy Hunt to undertake a root and branch review of universal credit and extend the government's £900 million cost of living crisis household support fund, currently at risk of being axed from next April. The fund provides emergency help such as food vouchers, beds and cookers to struggling families. Brown's comments came as he published a review of UK hardship on behalf of his multi-bank project, a network of local charities developed out of the office of Gordon and Sarah Brown, which sources and distributes millions of surplus goods to families in need. The review predicts the current crisis, the cost of living crisis, is the phrase, but the cost of staying alive crisis might be a better description, will continue for many households because food and fuel prices remain high and universal credit levels are far too low to meet rising bills. As a Chancellor and then Prime Minister in Labour governments between 1997 and 2010, Gordon Brown oversaw plans that significantly reduced levels of UK poverty through spending on tax credits and social programmes, such as the minimum wage and Sure Start. The subsequent huge cuts to welfare spending under Coalition and Tory governments from 2010 led to a collapse in benefit levels and an explosion in severe poverty. In 2022, an estimated 1 million children experienced destitution in Britain, meaning their families were unable to afford to properly feed, clothe, or clean them, or keep them warm. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, economy is a key defining point. Economy, of course, is not an ideal of the Islamic society. Rather, it is a means without which one would not be able to fulfill the ideals. Relying on imports rather than domestic strength and potentials, very limited exploitation of the country's human resources potentials, defective and unbalanced budgeting, and finally, lack of consistency in executive economic policies, disrespecting priorities and excessive and even wasteful expenses in parts of state organizations. The result is problems in people's livelihoods, including the high rate of unemployment among the youth, low income of lower classes, etc. The solution to these problems lies in the strong, responsible, and lively implementation of the policies delineated by the economy of resistance that need to be outlined, followed up, and acted upon by administrations. The country's economic intra-production, becoming productive and knowledge-based, making the economy popular, avoiding authoritarian government oversight, and extroversion using aforementioned potentials are among important examples of these solutions.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A young, wise, faithful, and knowledgeable committee of economy experts inside the government can undoubtedly accomplish these aims. The times ahead must be employed for action by the committee. The beloved young individuals across the nation should know that all solutions lie within the country. Assuming that economic problems are merely the result of sanctions, and sanctions are because of resistance against imperialism and not submitting to the enemy, so the solution is to kneel before the enemy and kiss the wolf's paw, is an unforgivable mistake. This completely false analysis, although sometimes emitted from the mouths and pens of some ignorant individuals inside the country, has its roots in foreign think tanks and conspirators who intend to induce them in policymakers, decision makers, and the general public inside the country.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.